Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, remembering Saint Martin de Porres, canonized 50 years ago. The Sistine Chapel and the legacy of the keys 5 centuries on. But first, as always at this time of week, we join Gilbe Villacqua, who presents her weekly reflections on the Sunday Gospel, for this, the 31st Sunday of the year, a programme which begins with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
One of the scribes came up to Jesus and asked him, "Which is the first of all the commandments?" Jesus replied, "This is the first. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Lord alone. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the second. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." The scribe said to him, "Excellent teacher, you are right in saying, 'He is the one, there is no other than He.' Yes, to love Him with all our heart, with all our thoughts, and with all our strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves is worth more than any burnt offering or sacrifice." Jesus approved the insight of this answer and told him, "You are not far from the reign of God." And no one had the courage to ask him any more questions.
From the account in last week's Gospel of the healing of the blind beggar, Bartimaeus, in Jericho, we've made a great leap. Jesus is now in Jerusalem and has been for the last few days. Indeed, these are his last days, for it is the Tuesday of what we know as Holy Week, and for the Jews, these were the days leading up to the Passover. The Pharisees have done their best to entangle Jesus in his talk with the question of whether it was lawful to pay tribute to Caesar. Then the Sadducees, who didn't believe in the resurrection of the body, posed him the question of the woman who had married 7 brothers. Jesus demolishes each group in turn. Told to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, the Pharisees marvelled, we read, and they left him and went away. But they can't have gone far, for this is what we hear next.
When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they came together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him.
That's the Revised Standard Version of Matthew's account. The Jerusalem Bible is similar.
The Pharisees got together, and to disconcert him, one of them put a question.
In the Jerusalem Bible version of Mark's account, we read,
"One of the scribes who had listened to them debating and had observed how well Jesus had answered them now came up and put a question to him."
Similarly, the Revised Standard Version has this.
"One of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he was answering them well, asked him."
What is interesting is the difference of emphasis between Matthew's and Mark's accounts. Mark tells us that the scribe was impressed by the way Jesus had answered the Sadducees. Matthew gives us a different reason for the scribe's query: to test him, to disconcert him, and in the Vulgate version, tempting him. What was the scribe's real attitude? Perhaps somewhat ambivalent. But after hearing our Lord's words, he comes down totally on the side of Jesus with an exclamation of approval, and then launches into his newly discovered understanding. But what prompted the particular question he asked? Didn't he know the order of the 10 Commandments? As children, we recited them in the order they were given to Moses on Mount Sinai, and the first was the longest of all, and very impressive it was.
"I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven thing, or the likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, nor of those things that are in the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not adore them, nor serve them."
Probably children today learn a simplified version of the commandments. But I wonder, do they have the same effect of instilling awe? Was it only the preponderance of these and thous, or the majesty of the language then used that impressed us so much? None of us, of course, have had the accompaniment of what we might call the sound effects provided by God for the Israelites gathered that day on the great plain at the foot of Mount Sinai. Not even Hollywood has been able to reproduce them satisfactorily.
There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain, and Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder.
God was not playing games, as a scholar reminds us.
The manifestation on Mount Sinai, chosen by God as the focal point of his presence, has the purpose of inspiring a proper sense of respect for the majesty of God, who has allowed his people to meet him here and is about to proclaim his will to them.
The effects had their effect. The people, we read, shook with fear and kept their distance, asking Moses to act as interpreter, or middleman, if you like, between them and God. And Moses spoke words of comfort and explained what it meant to have what we know as fear of the Lord.
Do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that your fear of him being always in your mind may keep you from sinning.
Later, as we know, Moses was called again by God to the top of Sinai, where he gave him the stone tablets with the law inscribed on them. But Moses stayed up there 40 days, and when he came down, he saw the people dancing round in adoration of the golden calf, and he hurled the tablets of stone down in fury. But to return to our scribe and his question, which is the first of all the commandments, it might seem a foolish query, except for one thing. The question the scribe poses refers not to 10 commandments, but to 613, 365 of which were negative, and 248 positive. A scholar explains.
These were various religious precepts which Jewish theology had catalogued according to symbolic calculations carried out on the basis of legislative texts of the Old Testament.
And another note goes into more detail.
The question of a distinction of importance among the commandments of the law was much discussed among the rabbis in the time of Jesus. One rabbinical text states precisely, "If the precepts are distinguished for greatness and importance, it is for practical and pastoral reasons. In this sense, there may be a greater and more important commandment. Which is the commandment that brings together all the others?" You answer, "The prohibition of the worship of idols." Famous is the answer of the great teacher Hillel to the pagan who asked him to teach the whole law standing on one leg. He said, "Do not do to your neighbour what is hateful to yourself. This is the whole of the law. The rest is its interpretation. Go and learn."
Hillel was a first-century Jewish teacher, one of the most respected of his time, and, we're told, influential on later rabbinic Judaism. In answering the scribe's question, our Lord makes no reference to all the hundreds of precepts Jewish theology had developed, but he quotes the words of Moses to the people, and then of God to Moses. And the scholars again explain.
Jesus refers to two biblical passages from Deuteronomy, love for God with one's whole being, and from Leviticus, love for one's neighbour as for oneself. Not so much to list two important commandments, but rather suggesting an interior attitude, constant and radical. The attitude of that love which pervades and transforms everything, giving life to morals and to worship itself. The whole of biblical law is summed up in this commitment to the way of total love for God and for our brothers. It is what the doctor-scribe understands, receiving explicit praise from Jesus. It's the only time in the Gospels that the students of the biblical law, the scribes, that is, are commended.
And one thing the man says stands out, the comparison he makes with sacrifices and burnt offerings. Maybe he was thinking of those lines from Ecclesiasticus.
A man multiplies offerings by keeping the law. He offers communion sacrifices by following the commandments. By showing gratitude, he makes an offering of fine flour. By giving alms, he offers a sacrifice of praise.
The last part of our gospel suggests a kind of peace, as if there was at last some real possibility of understanding between Jesus and those who have so far always contested him. But it's only a momentary peace, and we hear no more of the scribe who was not far from the reign of God. One hopes that he made it all the way. Finally, we hear that no one had the courage to ask him any more questions. And this statement we find also in Matthew, at the end of the discussion which follows, and which Mark also recounts. Jesus asks the Pharisees whose son they think the Christ is, and they answer, David's. How is it then, says Jesus, that David calls him Lord? And he quotes the psalm.
The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and I will put your enemies under your feet.
And a scholar explains.
Everyone knew that the Messiah had to be a son of David. But Jesus, with an argument typical of the rabbis, invites them to take notice that the Messiah is greater than his ancestor David. In fact, David, saying that the Lord invites the Messiah to sit at his own right hand, calls the latter my Lord. Therefore, Jesus argues, the Messiah is superior even to David.
And so, writes Matthew, no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions.
And warm thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for this programme by the title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now I'd like to join my colleague Linda Bordoni, who brings us a feature focusing on the figure of St. Martin de Porres, 50 years on from his canonisation in 1962. Stay tuned.
On November the 1st, the Church celebrates all the saints, canonised or beatified, and the multitude of those who are in heaven. During the early centuries, the saints venerated by the Church were all martyrs. Later on, the Pope set November the 1st as the day for commemorating all the saints. It's a feast that should inspire us with hope. Among the saints in heaven are some whom we have known. All lived on earth, lives like our own. They were baptised, marked with the sign of faith. They were faithful to Christ's teaching. It's also a good day to remember a saint that maybe brought particular inspiration to your life, like St. Martin de Porres, who earned himself the name of Martin of Charity for his devotion to his work, no matter how menial.
He excused the faults of others. He forgave the bitterest injuries, convinced that he deserved much severer punishments on account of his own sins. He tried with all his might to redeem the guilty. Lovingly, he comforted the sick. He provided food, clothing, and medicine for the poor. He helped, as best he could, farm laborers and Negroes, as well as mulattoes, who were looked upon at that time as akin to slaves. Thus, he deserved to be called by the name the people gave him, Martin of Charity.
These are the words Pope John XXIII chose to remember St. Martin de Porres when he canonized him in 1962. The humble servant of God, whose feast day we celebrate on November the 3rd, was born in Peru in 1579. He was the illegitimate son of a Spanish nobleman and a young freed black slave and grew up in poverty. Aged 11, he became a servant in the Dominican Priory in Lima, where he begged more than $2,000 a week from the rich to support the poor and the sick. Placed in charge of the Dominican's infirmary, known for his tender care of the sick and for his spectacular cures, his superiors dropped the stipulation that no black person may be received to the holy habit or profession of the order, and Martin took vows as a Dominican brother. He established an orphanage and children's hospital for the poor children of the slums. He set up a shelter for the stray cats and dogs. Martin lived in self-imposed austerity and spent much time in prayer and meditation. Saint Martin de Porres was, and still is, a much-loved saint, as my friend Father Peter Fleetwood told me. A saint with a rather special characteristic, and with a lesson of particular value in this day and age.
I think most of the time, when you look at saints in the mission lands, you're looking at people who've gone from Europe to these faraway places to bring religion with them.
Monsignor Peter Fleetwood is a former Vatican official at the Pontifical Council for Culture and an expert on Muslim relations in Europe.
To bring God with them almost, which is a mad idea, because they always taught us in the catechism lessons, where is God? God is everywhere. I think you don't bring God with you. You might bring perhaps an awareness of God with you. But in this case, Martin was from Peru. He was a local boy, I suppose. So there you have a case where the church recognised the holiness of somebody from that situation rather than saying, giving them the idea that some people have sometimes said that the only people who ever get made saints are the ones who've come from the headquarters, so to speak. So here you have someone, a real Peruvian, a real Christian, and somebody who's won the hearts of an incredible number of people throughout the world. I know that even my dad has a great devotion to him, maybe because it's on his birthday, the feast. But I don't think it's just that. And then if I think of my own home diocese of Liverpool, one of the nicest chapels in the whole cathedral, which is a very modern building, is the chapel devoted to Martin de Porres. And it's there because our priests who work in the South American mission are entrusted to the spiritual care of St. Martin, really. And on or about St. Martin's Day, the Liverpool Archdiocesan Missionary Project, LAMP for short, they have a massive collection in the diocese. I say massive because they have lots of collections, but this is the biggest one in terms of people's response. They automatically respect what is done in South America for people in very poor parts of very big countries, and Martin is their patron.
It must make a difference also to the people who are receiving his message. I mean, if somebody from your own background, from your own culture, comes to you with a message, it must make a difference to you. It must have a different impact as opposed to somebody who comes from outside, from a whole different world, with a whole different culture. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, and I think that's over the last century there's been canonizations of people from some places where we Europeans probably don't even know how to say the names properly, like Andrew Dunglack, the saints who are patrons of Korea, Vietnam. They're all martyrs from there. They've been the Ugandan martyrs for some time. Even people in the Pacific who were homegrown saints. You know, so you have to say, why not? And that's a good thing because they'll see we have grown into the faith. The faith has grown into our national culture. It's not just something imported. One thing that used to disturb me a lot when I was working in Rome for the Council for Culture was how many bishops' conferences would come from distant parts of the globe and say, we're still perceived as purveyors of a European ideology. What we bring is a European religion. On a silly level, one could say, well, it began in Asia anyway, because that's where the Holy Land is. But I know what they mean. They're treated by the local religious majority. I suppose any weapon can be used to make them feel a minority and make them feel out of place. And to accuse them of being European is one of the worst things that could be said to them. But it is, and they feel it's hard for them.
Is this what we call enculturation?
That word is probably out of fashion. I know the Pope prefers interculturality, and I think I see what he's on about, because enculturation can be putting certain principles onto a culture, adding something to a culture, or changing the message in order to make it acceptable to that culture. But if it's an interculturality, I think there's a possibility of getting the cultures getting to know each other, getting to learn from each other, which is that's the big miracle, that's the big challenge, I think, is when both sides say, I've got something to learn. You know, even Christianity from one part of the world might say, yes, our faith is the faith in a way, but if I go abroad to a culture I don't know, maybe there's something there for me to discover about my faith. You know, there's a paradox there, and I think people like Martin de Porres just are there as little reminders at the back of our minds. You do have something to learn. You haven't got all the answers.
And while our thanks there go to Linda Bordoni and her guest, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, it's time to go arty as we mark 5 centuries since the unveiling of the Sistine Chapel in time for the Feast of All Saints in 1512.
The Sistine Chapel, a place dear to the late Pope John Paul II, who once wrote about it in a collection of poems known as A Roman Triptych. Professor of Fine Arts Breda Ennis, who knows the chapel well and has read these poems, shares with us her emotions, putting the spotlight in a special way on Michelangelo's fresco depicting the Last Judgment.
There are only almost 400 figures in this particular fresco, so that should take about 4.5 weeks, no? Generally, people don't have much opportunity to concentrate on the Last Judgment because you're rushing through the Sistine and you're moved along. You never get what they call a full view of the Last Judgment of Michelangelo. But the cardinals in conclave have a lot of time to contemplate this magnificent masterpiece of Michelangelo's. And again, going back to what John Paul II himself said about this particular fresco, that he felt the importance of this fresco could not be underestimated, especially in relation to the conclaves, because they were coming into conclave to share in the legacy of the keys. So the work here is to give the keys of Peter to another person. And you see even up here on the wall, on the second level, because this fresco is divided into different sections. On the top you have 2 little lunettes, which are like little curved corners, where you have angels, wingless angels, holding the attributes of the Holy Week of the Crucifixion. And then below that you have a whole area where you have the patriarchs, the martyrs, the apostles, and I won't speak about the centre in the middle for the moment. And then we come down, and in the centre you have the angels heralding the last day and the day of judgment. On the left you have a mass of figures coming out of their graves, taking human form again and going up towards heaven and being helped up by other wingless angels. On the right-hand side you see the damned being taken in a boat down into hell. So you have the totality of the sacrifice of Christ on the top, which was made in order to stop people having to come down on the right-hand side. And, for example, you have also the Book of Judgment, where you have a book judging the people who are saved, which is much smaller than the book which has the names of those who are not. So it's a warning. There is a life, there is a salvation beyond this wall. He puts in all his figures, but he leaves all this wonderful blue. So when you're looking at it, you feel that the wall becomes dematerialized and all of these figures are just hanging there in space. And beyond that is where God is. So the responsibility for the cardinals who see themselves in the midst, the beginning and the end, between the day of creation on the ceiling and the day of judgment. And the Pope said Michelangelo has to speak to them. He has to teach them. He has to help them towards linking into the Holy Spirit. And on the top part here, in the centre part, where you have this magnificent figure of Christ in the day of wrath, the Dies Irae, he has his arm raised with great authority, and he's portrayed as a young man. He used to be portrayed as a young man in Paleo-Christian art, not so much later, because we always saw him with long hair and sort of beard, etc. Here's a young man without beard raising his hand in power and the power of the Holy Spirit. And beside him you have the Madonna, who's in this beautiful position where she's sort of slightly in an S position, where she's, there's a little torsion in the figure. And this blue, the blue of her robes is unlike the blue in any other part of the Last Judgment. And also you have this lovely violet colour, which is again a colour that was used on the ceiling in the creation scenes by Michelangelo for God. And she's turning sideways as if to say, oh my goodness, oh please, compassion, please help. So the people who are obviously going to be in serious trouble here, let's say. Pope John Paul II said, when I die, I want this chapel, I want this Last Judgment, I want this work of Michelangelo to speak to the people who remain after me, to speak to my cardinals, to make sure that the keys, Peter's keys, find themselves in the right hands. That once again, Michelangelo will wrap the cardinals in his vision.
In the beginning, God created. He who sees all things. The colors of the Sistine will then speak the word of the Lord. Tu es Petrus, once heard by Simon, son of John. To you I will give the keys of the kingdom. Those entrusted with the legacy of the keys gather here, letting themselves be enfolded by the Sistine's colors, by the vision left to us by Michelangelo. So it was in August, and again in October, in the memorable year of the two conclaves. And so it will be once more when the time comes, after my death. Michelangelo's vision must then speak to them. Conclave, a shared concern for the legacy of the keys of the kingdom. Lo, they see themselves in the midst of the beginning and the end, between the day of creation and the day of judgment.
And you were listening there to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome. She'll be bringing us more features focusing on the artwork in the Sistine Chapel in the coming weeks to mark this special anniversary. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again next weekend, as from Saturday. As of last week, in fact, the feature programme was no longer available on these frequencies in this half-hour format. I'd like to stress our weekend service will not be affected. However, you can find all our news and interviews on our website. That's simply rv.va. You can then click on the English World icon and the online menu will guide you through. Please do get in touch with us and let us know what you think of these changes and how we can continue to provide the best service to all of you. We do look forward to hearing from you on our email address, english@vatiradio.va, or on our mailing address, which is simple enough. It's The English Programme, Vatican Radio, 00120, Vatican City. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's feature programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.